Welcome to the GBC Big Three podcast, our weekly podcast where we sit down and unpack three big questions raised during our Sunday services. I'm your host, Matt Willis, and this week joining us again for another Big Three, my co-host, Mark Coleman. Mark, we are in what, week three or week four of this physical distancing, social isolation, regulation space. What is that one thing that you are missing the most? That one thing that when they finally let us out, that you are just running towards hammer and tongs?
I'm not sure I'm ever able to narrow it down to one thing. But I certainly am missing being able to eat food in a cafe rather than take it home in a plastic container. And I am also slightly missing the freedom just to walk by the beach without a sense of guilt or a fear that people are questioning whether or not you should be out or not. And also, you know, if you accidentally cough, the kind of the reactions from people.
The shame that you receive. I walked my son to daycare the other day and I sneezed. Not because of any other reason other than hay fever, but someone saw me and the judgment I felt, I quickly ran home. It was horrid.
It's not even a symptom.
No, it's not. It's not. And that's what I wanted to say, but I just ran instead. Also joining us after bringing us an amazing word on Sundays, Mark Radar. Mark, slightly different question. Coming out of this physical distancing space, what is a silver lining that you found, something that you are noticing that you're actually enjoying out of this whole new experience?
I think, you know, from a church perspective, I think I'm not sure that I'm enjoying it, but I think that the potential that we have now to strengthen our life groups, work out some of the kinks in our congregational care because we kind of have to. I think that's a bit of a silver lining in this. I think just having the family around a little bit more. Our girls are at an age where they're not, you know, once you take soccer and work and everything else out of their lives, having them around all the time isn't actually all that busy. So it's just kind of a different kind of pace of life. And on a really kind of personal level, it does mean that the Toronto Maple Leafs are probably not going to have to play the Boston Bruins in the first round of the playoffs. Again, that doesn't mean anything to very many people, but it is a bit of a silver lining for me right now.
Because you don't have to see your team like be pummeled into the ice?
No. If they were pummeled, it would be one thing. The chances are they're going to get up 3-1 in this best of seven series and then choke it away again.
Oh, okay.
It's just devastating.
So it's just saving you from potential pain.
That's it.
Well, I'm glad for you, mate. I'm so happy. Well, this week, Mark spoke on the Church at the Crossroads, which unpacked five misconceptions around suffering and how they can lead us to have doubt in our faith. You can listen to that sermon through our regular GBC Sermons podcast. But today, as always, we're going to unpack three big questions submitted through Slido during our Sunday services. So gents, let's get into the big three. Now, Mark, to kick us off, obviously your message circled around how suffering can lead us to experience doubt in our faith and doubt of God. And doubt isn't necessarily in and of itself a bad thing, but I guess left unchecked, it can see us spiral and have, I guess, huge implications on our relationship with God. So I guess that leads us to our first question. How do we acknowledge doubt without being consumed by it?
Yeah, I think that, I think it's really important to acknowledge that doubt in and of itself is I think it's quite natural. It's a normal part of faith. And I think that, I mean, to some degree, the simplest answer to that question is by acknowledging doubt. I think doubt does a lot of damage to us when we bottle it up inside, when we start to tell ourselves that we shouldn't feel that way or that we can't feel that way, or this doubt suggests that I'm not a Christian or whatever it might be. And we keep that then to ourselves. Yeah. There's great power in normalizing what we're going through, right? And there are very few doubts that that people will have that no one else has, right? Chances are the doubts that you're experiencing, you know, in this case, particularly around suffering. I mean, these are the common questions that people have always had around suffering. And so naming those, actually saying, you know what, sometimes when these sorts of things happen, I doubt that God is good. I don't know how to work that out. that there's a normalizing process. Like yeah. I still remember when, you know, when the girls were much smaller, you know, you go from being a kind of a competent adult to having these little children at home and you can't get them to fall asleep. You don't know what they're doing when they're crying. Like you just can't figure it out. And what was most powerful for Nicole and I was just having conversations with other new parents.
Yeah.
And what you learn is this is normal.
Mm.
Now that doesn't make it any easier, but at least you know that you're not incompetent, you're not completely missing something
yeah.
that everyone else has managed to kind of handle. So I think normalizing it is one of the most powerful ways that we can keep doubt from consuming us. I think that I think that's probably the simplest answer.
Yeah. Yeah. Coleman, do you have any reflections about this?
Yes. I mean, I totally agree with Mark, and they were my first thoughts as well, is that kind of doubt gains its strength in the darkness, and that's the kind of space where, you know, I think the enemy works in us, is, you know, the silencing that keeps us from kind of raising those questions in community, having conversations with people, and kind of going, oh, actually, I'm not the only person who has had questions around this.
Yeah.
And I really agree. I think that's you know, acknowledging doubt and actually having honest conversations about it. It kind of removes a lot of its power, and I think it's a really important kind of part of growing in our faith as well, because, you know, doubt is actually what promotes and prompts those kind of questions in us, and paying attention and learning to pay attention to doubt, I think, is a really helpful way of becoming a whole life learner. It's a helpful way of kind of going, well, actually, like, I'm not sure in this area.
Yeah.
I need to do a bit more digging. I need to have some conversations with people. I need to read a bit more about this and kind of explore that. And so in some ways, you know, I think, like, doubt is absolutely got to be an integral part of our faith, because it's a great way of us growing. And I think, you know, fearing it is something that kind of hems us in and can cripple us, but actually embracing it can be, you know, hugely beneficial.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love that idea of, like, we shouldn't do it alone. No. I remember when I first came to church, like, I was later in life, I was a late bloomer to Jesus, and that's cool. But I remember coming here and looking around the place and being like, man, everyone's got it sorted. And I'm over here with all my baggage and stuff, and didn't feel like I could share that. Didn't feel like, because I felt so far behind, and yeah, I felt like there was a disconnect. And it got me thinking, actually, there was a question that came up on Slido around doubt, which I think, you know, you guys are kind of talking about here, but I'd like to put it to you if I can, because it was, how do we allow space to doubt here at GBC? So how do we, as a community of faith, as Guymie Baptist Church, how do we create those opportunities for people to say, hey, actually, yeah, I do have doubt. Like, I don't want to pretend. I don't want to be the person who looks like I'm all polished when really inside I'm struggling. How do we create that space? Raider?
This sounds like a fourth question.
It does sound like a fourth question.
Yeah, no, it's a good one to ask. And I think it's something that is, the responsibility lies with those who are a little bit further down the track. Right? So again, if I can go back to the whole parenting thing and the normalization of that, when my girls were, you know, like, entering their toddler age, I needed to listen to people who had kids a little bit older than mine, not kids who were younger, because we were kind of done that part and they weren't going to tell me anything about the toddler stage. Right. And sometimes we can end up, if we voice our doubt to people who are not as far down the track as we are, we can end up not being particularly helpful. So I think it's attendant upon those who are a little bit farther down the track to voice those doubts and to say, kind of, but in a past tense.
Yeah.
Right. Now, not to say that, you know, oh, I've dealt with that question and I don't worry about suffering at all anymore, but to be able to say, yeah, that's a really big question. I've grappled with it. I'm not sure there are any particular answers, you know, that are definitive one way or the other, but this is how I've come to grips with that. I find, you know, teaching at the college, there's great power in me being able to to ask questions about a text, right? Mm. It's the same sort of thing. So when I state, you know, look at what God, like, look at God's activity in this passage. Isn't that weird? Like, isn't it, it's just inscrutable. We can't figure it out. And the students, you can almost, there's almost an audible sense of, he asked the question, you know, that we all ask whenever we read this, but we kind of thought we can't.
Yeah.
And there's great power in people who have been followers of Jesus for a longer period of time, being a little bit more comfortable.
Mm.
Again, not to say, oh yeah, that's a huge doubt and yeah, you'll never get over it. You know, that's not going to help. But just to be able to say, to make their space for people to say, I don't know what to do with this or that.
Yeah.
I've got real doubts and questions. How do I make my way through it?
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Common, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I would really agree with that. I think, you know, we have to become people who kind of lead the way in that and create space for doubt. Because for exactly the reason that you mentioned, is that, you know, we're always having new people kind of join church and in a different way, I guess, now often that's in the comments section, I suppose, in our online church, but even interactions that, you know, we might be still having with our friends, and normalizing doubt is a really important part, I think, of, you know, kind of being mature in your faith.
Mm.
Because I think it's kind of evangelism in some ways.
Yeah.
It creates that space for that. But I think the only other thought I was having in that space is, you know, what does it look like to not share our doubts? And like, are there times when that's appropriate as well?
Mm.
And I think, you know, whilst I think the general trend is to shut up and not talk about our doubts, and I think we need to find a way of kind of cracking through that, because I do think that encourages growth. It also encourages community.
Yeah, absolutely.
But there are times when just the kind of relentless airing of our doubt can actually be unhelpful in a context.
Mm.
And I think sometimes we kind of have to know when is appropriate to air the doubt, because sometimes actually that's an inward thought, and it's something we need to go away and think about a bit more and kind of get a little bit further down the line on, because actually our sharing of our doubt in that space may not be helpful in the context that we find ourselves in.
Yeah.
And I don't want to overstate that, but I do want to acknowledge, I think that's an important part of this too.
Absolutely. I think that's an awesome segue into question two. So, Rader, you were talking, one of the practical applications that you gave for us in your message was finding a travel partner, someone who you can do this life of faith with. And I don't think that's, it doesn't take a stretch of the imagination to kind of consider that that would be a part of faith. You know, when faith is all about our relationship with God, it seems to make sense that we would also then be called into relationship with one another. So this leads us to our second question. What makes a good traveling partner?
Mm. There's probably any number of ways to describe or to answer that. I think some of it depends on kind of where you are in the journey of faith as well. So some people talk about, what is it, having a Timothy and a Barnabas, taking the Apostle Paul. So he had Barnabas, who was his colleague in ministry, his peer, and they kind of grappled with stuff together. And then he had a Timothy who he was mentoring, right?
Yeah.
And you can imagine that as a Timothy, you would want to have a Paul, right?
Yeah.
You know, so I think that the idea of where, like, kind of being self-aware, where are you up to in your faith? If you're just starting out, you need to get yourself at least a Barnabas, and probably a Paul. But once you're on the road a little bit, you probably need a little bit of each, right?
Yeah.
Because each of those relationships challenge us in different ways, right? When you have someone who is a mentor to you, they can speak into your life in a particular way. You learn things though from mentoring, you know, that premise of the best way to learn something is to teach it.
Yeah.
Boy, is that ever true. You know, when you have someone who's asking you questions, when they're asking you about, you know, I've got these doubts about faith, and you're like, wow, I've never really thought about how I'd answer that,
yeah.
Boy, does that force you to clarify. Oh, that's yeah. really good. And having peers who you can walk alongside with is really quite critical. Mm. You know, C.S. Lewis talks about, you know, having, well, I think the language he uses is the first friend and the second friend. The first friend is the person who just sees everything the same way you do. You're like two peas in a pod, basically. Mm-hmm. The second friend he describes is the person who brings out the best in you, but disagrees with you on everything.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I think there's real value in having some traveling companions who push you, those mm-hmm. peers, shall we say. So if I can kind of mush those two kind of models together, we're talking about, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about the Barnabases almost, right?
Yeah.
Those peers who you just really resonate with, but then also having some peers who really challenge you, who see the world a little bit differently, who mm. might think about faith from a different perspective, that can be really valuable as well. So I'm not sure that there's any one ideal person.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it depends on kind of where you're up to in the journey of faith. At the same time, you want someone who, you know, to some degree encapsulates some of the values we're talking about.
Yeah.
Someone who's a learner themselves, someone who is big-hearted and generous, who's mm. others-focused. You know, some of those sorts of big characteristics are pretty important. Mm. I think the one that I mentioned, particularly in relationship to, you know, to doubts and mm. questions, I think you need someone who can listen and who's non-anxious,
mm.
right?
Yeah.
Someone who, when you say, I've got doubts and I'm my faith is wobbling, doesn't go, you know, and freak out yeah. and going, oh, no, you can't think that. Don't do you. It's okay.
Yeah.
You need someone who can kind of say, yeah, I can see how those questions would really rattle your faith.
Yeah.
Let's talk about how we're going to move that through. Because one of the worst things that can happen when you're going through a crisis is if everyone's panicking around you, that doesn't help. Mm. You're going to freak. If the first thing you say, when you dare to say, I've got this doubt, people kind of go, the world's collapsing. Like, well, geez, what are you going to think?
Yeah.
Except that the world's collapsing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think in the context of doubts and questions, someone who is able to listen mm. and to really kind of get at, so what is it that, like, what's the real heart of your doubt? But also someone who's kind of a non-anxious presence who says, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
Let's stick at this. Let's not ignore this. Let's mm. not pretend and think it's going to go away. But okay, lots of people have experienced doubts, either on their way to faith or in their journey of faith, or sometimes, unfortunately, out of faith. Mm. There are ways to grapple with this. Let's work it through.
Yeah. Mm. Coleman, how do you see this playing out in life?
I firstly just really agree with, you know, a lot of what Marcus has said, and our fifth value is about being trustworthy, and I think in some ways that's a great characteristic for a friend,
mm.
you know, a traveling companion is someone who's trustworthy, and absolutely, you know, that doesn't mean they necessarily agree with you. I would totally, you know, kind of back Mark up on that, in that it's really important that you've got people who've in your life who've got different opinions to you, because mm. apart from anything else, as well as doubt being one of those kind of catalysts, I suppose, for learning, mm. that you know, people with different opinions kind of become agitators in our lives, and that kind of brings us to a place often of holy discontent and
yeah.
kind of going, I need to learn a bit more in this space. But you want to pick people who, even if they've got different points of view and different ways of going about things, are trustworthy,
mm.
because you need to be able to trust their thinking. You need to be able to trust the way that they are approaching their own journey of faith. And you also, you know, to kind of go deep with someone, and that's not going to be every relationship, mm. but a kind of good solid companion. You want to know that your feelings and thoughts and reflections are in a safe space when they're shared with that person.
Yeah.
And I think, I do think trustworthiness is a really key part of relationship and friendship. And I think having trustworthy traveling companions are a really important part of us of growing.
Mm. And I think that particularly with the person who disagrees with you, the person who has a different opinion, I think that's really a really critical piece, because you need to make sure that they're going in the same direction.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. Some people who have a different opinion than you are antagonistic. Mm-hmm. And we can be antagonistic back, yeah. Right? Let's, you know, let's be fair. But the end game is not to get to the same location. The end game is for you to see things my way. Mm. And so if you're going to find friends who are, the iron sharpens iron piece, right? Yeah. I think that it's really valuable to make sure that we're heading in the same direction. Like,
yeah.
Like I want what's good for your faith, not that you necessarily see things my way.
Yeah.
And so I think that could be one of those tricky spaces.
Yeah,
so.
No, I love that. All right, well, we'll wrap up with our third and final question. Now, I should caveat this, because normally this question would probably be saved for one of our special edition, the fourth question episodes. But when I read it, considering the context that we're in, I feel like this question is probably moving around a lot of people's minds. Mm. And so I kind of felt like it was important that we gave it a crack in the big three, particularly considering the message on Sunday. And so the third and final question is this: how do we reconcile a good God and experiences of suffering to those who don't have faith? Mm. Or if I can, even those with faith.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, this probably, it is a big question.
Mm.
I mean, you know,
we
could just have a whole podcast that just week after week talked about that
issue.
Yeah,
we could.
It might get a little bit old after a while, but nonetheless. And I think one of the first things that I would say, is we need to be aware, again, not just of where we are at, but where people that we're engaging with are at.
Mm.
You know, sometimes people ask questions about, say, suffering, for instance, and they're not really interested in leaning towards faith at all. They're just trying to stir it up a little bit.
Mm.
And so we need to be kind of aware of that and kind of look for the genuine in that. I think that's pretty important. Because that creates the basis for any kind of conversation.
Mm.
And then I think essentially we want to enter into the discussion.
Yeah.
I'm not sure this is the worst thing we can do. There's probably a bunch of things that aren't helpful, but I think one of the unhelpful things that we can do is project certainty in what's really a matter of faith.
Mm. Yeah.
Mm. You know, so I think saying to someone who doesn't believe and might be on the journey of faith, saying, oh yeah, I've got it all sorted out. Suffering's not a problem at all if you just think about it right. Mm. I just think that's really unhelpful.
Yeah.
I think we need to, you know, at the same time, I don't think we should say, oh yeah, no, that's an unsolvable question. You know,
yeah,
we're screwed.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. So I think we need to be able to say, no, listen, there are some, not plausible, but there are some valid answers to this.
Mm.
There are some ways to think about the world, as I tried to express a bit in the sermon, that give us a different perspective, a place to stand and look at suffering and see it differently. Mm. But I think to express certainty is really problematic.
Yeah.
For someone who's on the journey of faith, or someone who's, you know, who's in faith and is experiencing questions, to say that you should be certain makes it worse, right? It basically says something's wrong with your faith.
Yeah.
If you're having questions, what's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And so I think we have to be really careful about that. We want to enter into the conversation and say, well, look, here's some of the answers.
Mm.
Here's some of the ways that Christians have grappled with this, and go from there.
Mm. Mm. Coleman, thoughts?
I've actually been spending a bit of time reflecting in this space, and largely prompted by something I was listening to this week, like a devotional that I'm engaging with particularly at this time, and something was said on that devotional that really made me think, and quite often my response to the, you know, why does God allow suffering question, which is, you know, the kind of form of the question we're answering today, has centered around the idea that God is with us, and that is absolutely true, and I'm not going back on that kind of as a theological perspective, and also I think it's a really important thing to acknowledge in suffering is that, you know, God is with us in that space. But this podcast talked about the fact that that actually God has also gone before us. Mm. And I'm reminded in that suffering space when when we can get ourselves in the trap of thinking, oh, you know, I'm experiencing suffering, this might not be God's will for my life, to recognize that actually we're following in the footsteps of, you know, a savior who came to earth and suffered. And to expect that our life will look free of suffering, I think, is, you know, a distorted perspective of what it means to follow Jesus.
Yeah.
And of course, like, our sufferings are going to look different to that, and kind of what we step into is going to look different. But actually, I think there is something extraordinarily powerful and transformational in recognizing that Jesus has gone first in suffering, and he is the one who invites us into relationship following him, and that from that point, you know, as the person who's gone first through suffering, it creates for us a whole new dimension, an extraordinary power and strength to the idea that God is with us, because there's something about his character that means he's the best person to be alongside us as we face these things.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny that you should say that. This week, I've been reflecting over the Easter story. Go figure, it's Easter this weekend. It felt appropriate. And I found myself reading when Jesus goes to pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. Mm. And that passage has always been profoundly powerful for me for that exact reason, because I witnessed Jesus in such a raw state of vulnerability in that moment. You know, his disciples, lazy gits who have fallen asleep every 5 minutes. He's there pouring his heart out to his Heavenly Father, fearful of what's coming, knowing what's coming. Mm. And I make no claim of understanding the role of suffering in our world. I'm as in the dark as the person who asked this question. Mm. But I'm encouraged when in that moment of reading that passage, because I feel even more connected to my God because he understands my suffering. I may not understand why I suffer, but I follow a God who understands my suffering. Mm. And that's always been an incredibly powerful thing that I found, particularly around that verse.
Yeah, so. That's good.
And it's more, I think, even more than just comfort. It's knowing that you have got the best guide. We talk about traveling companions, the Holy Spirit, you know, the Spirit of Jesus with us is the best traveling companion through suffering.
Yeah. Amen. Well, gentlemen, thanks for joining us again for another week of The Big Three. If you want to be a part of the conversation, make sure that you log on to our services this Sunday at 8:30, 10:30 or 6 p.m. and snap the Slido QR code to get involved before the sermon. Just a reminder, we have decided to film The Big Three as well, and you can watch that at gbconline.org.au at 7 p.m. every Wednesday. If you've enjoyed the Big Three podcast today, make sure that you give us a star rating and subscribe so that you can stay up to date with all future episodes. Thanks for joining us for this week's Big Three and our deep dive into God's invitation for us all. Remember, there's no thought too small, no question too big.